Welcome everyone to episode 34 of the Greater European Talks. Now today we're talking about a topic that we talked to almost exactly a year ago, and that of course the situation in Lebanon, where last year we talked to Mariam, and she is back today to talk to us, as well as another figure to invite. So today I want to welcome again Mariam Nassef. Say hello, lovely to have you back.
Hi Philippe, it's lovely to be back. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And we're also bringing today Jean Sadeh, another Lebanese figure, good friend of mine, and we're very happy to have him on the podcast as well.
Hello, I'm like the Delta variant, so I'm new.
Fantastic. So with these two excellent friends and figures, we're going to discuss a little bit more about what's happened since the year that we talked about the situation in Lebanon. The prime minister designate resigned and the political situation is still in a free fall, but also a lot of other situations have happened, both political, economic and socially. And we're just here to give our listeners a bit of an insight and a bit of an understanding of the situation so they can not only get up to date with it, but also try and engage a little bit with the situation itself. So first, I just want to pass over to Mariam to explain a little bit about the current events, what they're feeling about it, maybe some personal insights. And then, you know, like most of our other discussions, this will be more of a chill debate over the discussion so we can really hear it from the people themselves. So Mariam, please take it away and I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Thank you. So I think if I want to give a nice, accurate representation of the situation, I'll start with saying that this podcast was, you know, we were supposed to talk yesterday, but then I couldn't make it because there was the generator providing electricity broke down and it could not be fixed. And there was like a diesel shortage. So the situation is simply put really bad. A year ago, it was bad, did not expect it to get worse. And I think at the time when we spoke, the blast, you know, the Beirut port blast did not take place yet. And I think that really facilitated and pushed the country over the edge post-blast. Today, we are facing, you know, severe electricity shortages. There's a fuel crisis. There's a severe medicine crisis. Life is very, very difficult, I think. And that it's only made worse by the economic crisis and, you know, the consistent devaluation, sometimes volatile devaluation of the Lebanese currency, which is, you know, pegged, still officially pegged to the Lebanese, to the US dollar. So the Lebanese pound is pegged to the US dollar. So wages have not gone up, but the prices have of everything. Just like it is with any other crisis, I think suppliers are holding onto their stock, which is making it really difficult for people to access basic goods and just necessities needed for everyday life, such as, you know, diapers and baby milk, for example. You know, so these have become luxuries in the country. That is, I think, a quick overview. But if I start talking, I don't think I'll finish. And I don't think the list is endless. And that's it. It's made even worse, like you said, by the, I would not call it disappointing because we saw it coming, but that is what it will be referred to, the resignation of the prime minister elect, because, you know, he failed to form a government and what little hope some people had left was gone with it. And that really, locally we saw a very, very volatile devaluation of the currency literally within 5 minutes of the resignation. So you can see that the volatile political environment and the hope that some people had left in the system is tied to the economic crisis.
Okay, thank you. No, that's a great sort of introduction or reintroduction, as it were, to the topic following from last year. Jora, is there anything you kind of want to add to the introduction? What kind of current themes do you think are still very dominant in this crisis that maybe have continued from the beginning or sort of been brought in?
Mariam did cover mostly everything, but like in more technical terms, we're kind of we have a political crisis, we have an economic crisis, we have a budgetary fiscal crisis. And so, yeah, it's like a conglomerate of all these things where no political will is present within the majority ruling the country to address anything. And we can also look at it from another perspective that you can infer what the intentions and the will of the political class is when they refuse to remove their immunities for prosecutions, and they are even trying to remove the prosecutor Bitar from doing his own job and to refer it to a non-existent entity that is supposed to be prosecuting prime ministers, presidents, and ministries, basically. So this is like just a compounding effect at the moment. But we have the issue of price control in the country, in which, as Mariam said, that the Lebanese pound is officially still pegged, and so you cannot have access to outside resources such as petrol, medications, or anything, except if you're willing to pay in US dollars, which is only basically a black market thing now with no regulation, no oversight, nothing whatsoever. So yeah, that's the basic theme, and things, as it looks, are going to just keep going worse and worse. So, and one thing I want to add is, like, when the explosion in Beirut happened, the pressure within the people and the revolutionary esprit that took hold in the country was so massive that Macron coming to the country and saying that we as France are going to take on charge the responsibility of forming a specialized government that is apolitical basically relieved the pressure from the street, and this basically just extended our suffering in the state, in which the people basically just gave that power to France and trusted in it. And then this initiative failed. So that's my two cents on it.
Mm-hmm. You come to a very good point. I was maybe going to talk about this later, but maybe we can start with this, kind of go from our side in. How have you both seen kind of the external reaction to this crisis? So you mentioned, Georges, obviously the President of France came to Lebanon. I believe more recently there have also been other figures from the French administration who've come to Lebanon to speak about, you know, overcoming this political situation. Of course, not just France. The US has been interested in having some stability. As you mentioned, of course, the Lebanese currency is pegged to the dollar. How do you view the outside relationships with Lebanon? And do you think they've helped, hindered? Or is there anything more they can do you think that could really help?
I might sound cynical, but I think it's useless. Like George said, you know, when President Macron came to the country and his statement kind of gave hope to some of the people who were on the ground. And so what they literally did, and you could see it was being broadcasted. 1 minute, the Lebanese people were protesting in the streets, demanding their rights. And then the next, right after Macron was on the streets, they left. They literally just packed their bags and went home and re-put their faith in the French, you know, the government, the initiative, the promises that were made. But they were just really empty promises, I think. And it's just one big pantomime. It's one big play. Lebanon is always subject to external forces and external political affairs. And it's a playing ground right now for other countries, because pressure is being exerted in different ways to control local political forces. And really, the only people that are being affected are the working class and the middle class and you know, people living under the line of poverty. Just Lebanese citizens, regular Lebanese citizens with no way out, are the people who are being affected by these empty promises. You know, and you're right, not long ago, I believe it was the French ambassador who directly attacked PM Hassan Diab. And I remember even myself looking and I was like, you know what? She's so powerful. But then I took a step back and I was like, okay, well, what's that going to do? I was, you know, in my car waiting for an hour in line, listening to the radio to fill up my car with petrol. And I was listening to that on the radio. And I don't know why I felt hope. I was literally in the middle of a hopeless situation. It's really one big political game. So I think at this point, I think what we want is just, George phrased it really beautifully, we want internal political will to make a change, because it's getting really, really obvious really quickly that external political, you know, affairs and governments and countries will not interfere and will not support the country unless they achieve their own agendas. Let's put it this way. And that's my perspective on the matter. And I mean, and I was one of the people who left the streets after the August 4th blast, but not because of the speech that President Macron gave, but it was rather because we were shot at. And so we kind of, you know, the hope, I lost hope back then, not gained hope. So it was a different kind of, you know, reaction.
I'm sorry to hear that. That's definitely a horrifying situation, being shot at. And I believe you even mentioned it to myself personally. You actually tried to help put some of the rubble away, right? You actually trying to help clean up after the blast.
Yeah, I was on the ground for a month straight. I'm still supporting with the rebuilding of Beirut. I was on the ground. I was helping people, you know, clean up their houses and helping them find funds to rebuild and just setting up temporary shelters for people and helping find, like, you know, food and medication, because that was really scarce in Beirut for around a week or 2 weeks. So yeah, I was on the street in the days I was cleaning up the rubble, and at night I was protesting. And then at some point I stopped protesting. I was just cleaning the rubble. So
I'm sorry to hear about the dire situation. Yeah, no, thanks for your input, definitely on the external situation. I mean, George, I mean, you both echoed kind of the idea there needs to be internal political will. I mean, on the same question, do you think there is anything that outside forces can actually do to help?
So I'm going to talk about this by referring to another historical event. It's like in 8th of March 2005, we had like the Thank You Syria protest in Lebanon, which had 200,000 people. And basically the Western world and the UN, basically countries, looked and said, okay, well, this obviously means that the Lebanese are content with the Syrian occupation in the country. So it's like, what? We're not going to go fight a battle that basically no one wants us to fight there. And Walid Fair is one of the advisors for the Trump administration, and he has connections with officials. He was very politically active in the US at that point, and he usually met with Congress members. And in 14th of March, you had almost 1.5 million people that went to the streets facing the fear of being shot at by Syrian and Lebanese troops. And that view of the people and the message was received by the West, which basically pushed them to tell the Syrians to get out of the country. What I'm hoping, I can't speak for Mariam, I don't know if she agrees with this, but I feel that the country is heading towards another historical event just like this, especially with the parents of those that were killed by the explosion. And because they've went to like a couple of politicians' houses to call for like the removal of immunities and stuff, and they were actually hit and shot at by police and like internal security forces and army forces. So people now might be very tired because of the economic situation. Like literally no one, all the bread makers in the country are just looking to working their whole day to get the bare minimum. And if this continues, this is going to push them to not be able to do that. So people are going to, their anger is going to blow up somewhere. And hopefully it blows up and things might be sliding towards a violent, I don't know what to call it, if it might be an insurrection, it might be a revolution, but things are not going to stay peaceful if they continue like that. And my hope that it doesn't turn violent and that the international community basically tries to give the political support umbrella through the UN, it could be through I don't know who, but in order to put things in perspective and maybe have an international investigation as some parties have called for and as the parents of those that were killed signed the petitions to the UN to conduct an international investigation regarding the port, because our own investigation is not going to have any result. And it's clear that the political class does not want any investigation regarding this. So
I don't necessarily disagree or agree with George, but I do have to point out something that he said. And that is actually, George, as we speak, the parents of the victims, the parents and friends and loved ones of the victims of the August 4th blast are currently protesting in front of the major Lebanese courthouse facing the Lebanese, you know, the General Security Center in Lebanon. They have closed off the roads and they are burning tires. And it's actually full chaos right now as we speak. And so there's quite some beautiful insight right there, which is I mean, I don't know if George was trying to say it's going to turn violent, but I hope it doesn't. And he quite explicitly said that, but it will turn violent. I do agree. I think it will turn violent, definitely more violent than it turned following the revolution of October 17th, 2019, or what some people refer to as the revolution. But will it lead to an insurrection and will positive change come out of it? I don't know. I'm more cynical, when it comes to answering that question in particular. Yes, it's going to get violent. Yes, it's going to get nasty. It already is, you know, it's already happening as we speak at this very moment. But will positive change come out of it? I'm not sure. We were hoping for that positive change following October 17th, 2019. In, you know, the events that followed, and nothing really came out of it, but the whole world at one point was listening to us and saw us. So really, I'm not sure. Right now, like you said, the blast adds kind of a new perspective to it, and the situation is much, much, much worse. And at some point, it's before it was a slogan, you know, before they used to say, I don't really have a job, so that's all I have. Protesting is all I have. Very soon, it's going to become in actual reality. So just wanted to add that to what George was saying.
Mm-hmm. No, it's quite sad to hear. I really hope that obviously the violence limits, but as you say, I mean, if things were already violent and bad before, they're only worse now. What I want to ask is, what stopped there from being changed back in 2019? And what, in your opinion, of course, this is something that everyone's been thinking about, and what needs to be there, let's say today or tomorrow, for there to be change? What is stopping the change from happening? And of course, you mentioned internal political will, but I don't know if it's structured somehow. I want to just kind of dig deeper a little bit into that. What needs to happen?
So from my perspective, it was a multitude of factors. I'll start with saying that the leadership of the revolution at the time was completely decentralized. There was no actual list of demands. There was no actual leadership, but it was pretty clear that, you know, change is needed. The more people were protesting, the longer the days went on, the more the demands became more, you know, politically affiliated. And then some certain political parties started jumping on the bandwagon and claiming, you know, certain parts of the protests as their own and using the protests to push their own political agenda. So we really were back to square one at one point. And some of us, you know, some of the people who were on the ground who truly were not affiliated with any political party or agenda and really just wanted reform and change and, you know, financial transparency and budgetary transparency. And please explain why you spent millions of dollars on pens, you know, things like that. We were very discouraged at one point. It was like, okay, are we really protesting for the right reasons with the right people? Because then you'd find yourself in the middle of a protest with people around you shouting racist slogans, and then that really became alarming to us at some point. So that there was, you know, political parties jumping on the bandwagon, there was decentralized leadership, and then you had the list of demands not being very clear. But then at one point it also became about survival. The longer you wanted to protest, that's the longer, the more time spent out of work. And in an economy that is collapsing, you needed to get back to work. You needed to make money, you needed to survive. Prices were only going up. And, you know, we weren't really finding more work. This was before the COVID-19 pandemic. So that really, as you can imagine, that made things much worse following, you know, a revolution, and then you got a pandemic, and that really, I think it played a role, but we were already in a complete state of disarray. So I think these reasons from personal experience, this was why it did not work out at the beginning. But then again, George said it beautifully, I'll say it again, the lack of will, the lack of political will. They were hearing us, but they were not listening. The people in power were hearing and they were not listening. They heard, you know, they would go out and make these false, like not false, but empty statements and empty promises, but they would not give up their seats. And and then you also have that was revealed back in 2019, a significantly large portion of the population is still very much affected by the civil war and the ideologies that followed, and thus they are, you know, sticking to their political parties and what their political parties want, no matter how independent they claim to be, there's still traces that have not been erased. So, you know, that's in my opinion, I believe that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. And just for our listeners, maybe, that kind of structure and the legacy of the Civil War, that's created a political system where essentially your sort of position, what party you belong to, what party you want to vote for, defines everything. And it's very hard to overturn that electorally as well, isn't it?
Yes, it's practically written into our electoral system. There's a power sharing scheme, and there's a gentleman's agreement that, you know, the prime minister is to belong to a certain sect and the president's belong to a certain sect. And so it's really written in as a result of the Taif agreement so many years ago. And then Lebanon is also structured in a way such that it's changing. But it's changing very slowly, but it's structured in a way such that, for example, you can find members of a certain sect all of living in the south, and then members of a certain sect living somewhere in the mountains, and they usually belong or support the same political party, and there are some divides sometimes, but yeah, that's the way it's structured mm-hmm. as a result of the war.
No, thanks very much. We'll definitely come back to that, I think, in a second, but George, I wanted to hand it over to you. Why do you think 2019 nothing happened, and what needs to happen now?
I don't really agree with that nothing happened, because and this is like one point of disagreement I have with Mariam, because the protests that happened that time had the goal of overturning the government. The government fell. So that is some, especially with like Hassan Nasrallah and Hezbollah going out and saying that the government will not fall no matter what, and it fell. So that I do consider to be a victory, but like that was the explicit goal. That was the most common denominator for all the people on this, like, or whatever subgroups they might be. That was the most common denominator, is that this government has to go. But what followed after was that, yes, as Mariam said, there was basically no coherent message from the street around it. And basically what happened is that 8th of March parties, which are the majority in the country, took charge with PM Hassan Diab. And they pushed their own government one color, and yeah, they had what they wanted. So, which then fell when he resigned. And so we're still in this. This is a year ago, by the way, 9 months ago since he resigned. So it's very decentralized at this point. And we don't really have a common, as Lebanese, don't really have a common ground on what we agree to next, especially now. And especially since, for me, if you have an elections or you win an elections, even if like those that call themselves a revolution or another political party gets 128 parliament members, you cannot do anything in the country while you have a militia that gets to do a coup d'etat whenever they feel that they can, if their interests are like an under attack. Other political parties also have their own shenanigans, but like none can stage a military coup like 2008 that happened in Beirut. And Mariam brought up something about the structure, about having like the prime minister being a Sunni Muslim, about the president being a Maronite Christian. Basically, that traces back to Sykes-Picot. And that was a major blunder because the American delegation that came to the region, they made everyone, like all the towns, vote. And basically, majority Muslim towns, they voted against being in Lebanon. They didn't want to be in Lebanon, but they were forced to. And so this basically created a system in which you oppressed a whole group of people against their own will to choose where they wanted to live, where they wanted to be associated with, the identity that they wanted. So, yeah, we ended up in a civil war because of us doing that and accepting that reality. In a way, to give reassurances to the sects, so they feel that they are secure and that no one's coming after them. They were all each assigned like a certain number of positions. The ministries were giving by 50-50, same as parliament members. So you're trying to fix a worse problem by giving such a solution, which doesn't really work. And this is going to continue. But as Mariam said, there are some changes around that. But I don't really think that the change will outpace another possible civil war if things continue to go as they are. So which would be recreating an even worse reality because of that.
That's quite grim. That's quite a grim statement. I think, you know, I want to disagree with you, but the afraid Lebanese in me wants to disagree with you. I think if you go on the streets right now, the one thing, I think one of the only things stopping people from getting violent is this fear of civil war. It's a fear of a second civil war, but we see it coming, you know? And I did not expect George to touch upon it so quickly, but he did. And I'm really happy he did, because it's true. I'd like to also boldly claim that I think it also was one of the reasons why the protests did not get messy or violent, because we knew that if our intentions or our actions were to be twisted by the right or by the wrong political parties, then that would lay the grounds for a war, a civil war, which, because remember, a lot of the older generation who have survived the civil war, they're still alive, they're still afraid, they've instilled that fear in their children, and then that fear is still present in my generation today. So we're trying to avoid that. I'm not sure if we will. I'm not sure if we can succeed.
I just want to add something that like puts even like the statement more grim. You can hear people around you that keep saying in the civil war, things were not so bad.
Yeah, yeah.
It just shows you that people, like, there's a certain nostalgia going around in people's minds. It's like, if like in war, okay, yeah, we had like people being killed next to us, but none of us died because we couldn't get medication. None of us died because we couldn't get food.
100%. Yeah. And people are actually using it as a way of saying, you know what, maybe if we did have war, then that would open up our borders and allow the flow of money, and that would solve some of our problems. And so that's horrible, but it's true.
Yeah, I mean, for our listeners involved, the Civil War, which I believe ended in 1990, I mean, it killed well over 100,000 people. And the tariff agreement you mentioned kind of made the parliament 50-50, 50% for Christians, 50% for Muslims and Druze as well, the other groups. I mean, and again, this is something that I'm sure our listeners think is something that maybe something I don't understand as easily here. If the division of parliament, the sort of the tariff agreement, this political system is partly one of the reasons for the lack of internal political will, are there any calls to get rid of it, restructure completely? Or, in your opinion, is that just tantamount to a second civil war? Because it sounds to me, and I might be mistaken in this, that those things are equated. If that agreement goes, if all these structures get dissolved, and if there's not sufficient reform, then to people that's almost as if violence is back on the street. Am I wrong? I hope I am. But
so if you have a conversation with, not all of them are the same, obviously, and I don't want to generalize, but if you have a conversation with people who survived the Civil War, so that would be my father's generation, my parents' generation or my grandparents' generation, they will tell you that at the time, you know, the Taif agreement and everything that followed and the way that the system currently is, that was the only way. They still say that was the only way. And because they are so attached to that concept of that was the only way, to them, they think that it's still the only way. And that if you take away the system, you're going to bring up some hatred. But they're not, I think, that's my personal opinion, that because we still have, you know, this fear of the civil war, and some parts of the country have still not yet recovered from the war, that yes, if you do take away the system that they believe protects their rights, that yeah, that might cause another civil war. But reform is more than necessary. The system is failing. You know, it's corrupt. It allows for people to get away with whatever they want, with at this point, literal murder as a result, you know, the Beirut blast. That's literal murder. And, you know, George said it at the beginning of the talk, that the members of the parliament themselves are not allowing the lifting of immunity. They're protecting each other. They're protecting once, and if you can't lift the immunity of these political figures, then they can't be tried, and justice will literally never be served. And so that is a clear example of how the system is failing. So reform is needed, but will it cause issues getting there? Will we ever get there? Will we ever get there? I don't know. I hope we do in this lifetime, at least. Will getting there cause an issue or a war? I think so. I'd like to hear George's opinion on this as well.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to give more of a historic view on Ta'if. And basically, Ta'if said that all the militias are to be disbanded. They need to give their weapons to the legitimate army. And the combatants of these groups, those that pass the physical and mental test, they can be recruited into the army. So it becomes like a national army. And that the Syrians will first be positioned in the Bekaa Valley, and after 6 months, they would withdraw back to Syria. So what happened is that the current president, Michel Aoun, opposed this agreement, and thus he waged an internal war within what was used to know the Christian area. So he decimated the militias that were against Syria and the army, which basically meant that there was no longer a viable opposition to the Syrian overtaking the country, and that's how the country fell. So the Ta'if agreement, instead of being an agreement of which there was a consensus around to stop the war, it became as a way to stop the massacre that was going to follow. So what happened is that when this was signed, all the militias were disbanded except those that were allied with Syria, which is the SSNP, the Syrian Socialist National Party, Amal, Hezbollah. And so these groups kept their arms, kept operating as paramilitary groups. And Syria actually took over the whole of the country, and they started assigning parliament members. They gave citizenship, like in Zahle, which where I know, they gave citizenship to around 20,000 Syrians, and they would only come to elect certain people when elections come, so they can control the number of parliaments, of parliamentary members. So yeah, it kind of, Ta'if was never really applied, and it still hasn't actually been applied, either to making the parliament a non-sectarian entity and creating a senate which basically holds the religious families, and from there they would have certain prerogatives and certain competencies. But also regarding the immunities, I've been meaning to write a legal paper surrounding this. It's the parliament members, their immunity is regarding their opinions. It doesn't regard the crimes they commit or actions. So that's one of the first things we need to clear out. But that's the Article 39. In Article 40, it says that a prosecution cannot be conducted against a parliament member when parliament is in session. And because the government is basically dissolved in Lebanon, we're in an exceptional Congress now. So you really can't go against, like prosecute someone, unless you can get them to recuse their immunity via the parliament. Also, the judge in this case can question them. The only thing he can do is put them under trial, but he can't question them. So the debate within the parliament now is that there was a document that was signed calling to remove this case from the judge and giving it to another entity that doesn't exist. So basically no investigation will be conducted, but pressure from the street basically made 5 of the 30 members that signed it to remove themselves from it and say that they are going to vote with it. But still the votes are not enough to actually conduct the removal of immunity. So that's the gist of it.
If I can just, thank you very much. I mean, the historical perspective is very useful for our listeners as well. If I can maybe bring this back to, well, essentially this week or last week, with we talked about the Prime Minister resigning. What's next? This is, if I'm not wrong, the third Prime Minister elect who has resigned, or if you include the government originally resigned in 2019, essentially the third, maybe more. Is there realistically any government left who you think could actually have the confidence of both the parliament and the people, which is a real difficulty here? And if not, I mean, are elections possibility? Is this a way forward in Lebanon? Kind of politically, what's the next stage? And if it's civil war or violent protest, then that makes this probably one of the saddest podcasts that I've hosted here. And I'm really sad to hear that. Or maybe to make it more hopeful, what do you hope is the next stage?
So this is the third resignation, but it's only the second PM to resign because what happened was that it was, you know.
Ah, okay.
It was Saad al-Hariri and then Hassan Diab and then, you know, Saad al-Hariri. And, you know, they all failed.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay. Yes, I understand. Yeah.
No, but it is the third resignation. Just, you know, you can tell we don't really have a very, you know, diverse portfolio of leaders in this country. It's really the same people over and over again. Hope, I don't know. I think they're trying to pass some laws that will, you know, like the, I think they're trying to pass it anyway, the law of, you know, providing food coupons to those living under the line of poverty, although the criteria for those, that law has not yet been set, or like, not law, but they haven't really done anything there. They've just, you know, proposed an idea. And they're trying, it seems like they're trying because the elections are really soon, so they're trying to regain control. Listen, I do see hope, okay, and I can tell you why I see hope, because in the unions, the worker unions, for example, the engineering union, the independent party or like the independent representatives were able to come out on top. So we see change in the smaller institutions. There's some change happening there. And it's not just like they're not just winning by a couple of votes. They're totally kicking ass. They're just winning they're taking all the votes. They want to change. They want to see something new. So I do have hope. But what happens between now and the parliamentary elections, I have no idea. The situation gets worse on a daily basis. And if we ever face like a blackout or something, and if me and, you know, the population living here have to go day in, day out, circling 6 or 7 pharmacies to find, you know, a regular antibiotic, we really won't have time to think about our basic human rights. So I do hope it works out, and I just hope it does not get worse from now until then, just so that people can actually, you know, find it in them to go and, I don't know, do something, peacefully protest, call for the rights. I'm not sure. I don't know. It's very chaotic right now.
Yeah, I think I came out at the start of this interview looking more optimistic than Mariam, and I'm going to end up being the pessimistic one. So, okay. So for me, an election, no matter what the results, will have like immoral impact, but basically what we had in the country is that we had a militia group that was thinking strategically because of its relation with Iran, and they basically got their strategic gains by giving tactical monetary gains, fiscal gains to other political parties, and in that manner others were like spitting the loot while this group was basically taking hold of the country. And like, no elections is gonna remove the power from your neck. And that's the thing, like, one of the things that I'm hopeful for is that if the international community forces the application of the international decisions of 1701 and 1559, which basically say the disarmament of Hezbollah and the removal of them, like their paramilitary groups, from the borders, and then the relinquishment of that to the UN forces or to Lebanese army forces, then yeah, I can see like some kind of hope, because now you're on a victim. So you're basically going politically against someone, but you can't fight politically against someone that's willing to shoot you and still use the military and use the internal security forces against you. And I think Mariam is also aware that now all the aid that the government is giving it's going to security members because they need their umbrella, they need their defense. And so, yeah, for me, the problem is so structural that you can't deal with it within a centralized system anymore. You can't deal with it in a unitary state. So you need to relinquish all the competencies of the central state to smaller communities, smaller towns, because they are basically the ones dealing with all the crises at this point. And we have basically never felt anything good from the central government. Like, the roads and hospitals that the government operates are still the ones that the French built since 1920 to 1940. Yeah, so we need to rethink our strategy about this country, and we need to think about these things, but we also need to have a clear messaging about it, because just winning an election with no plan on how to mount a defense or a counterattack against certain militia groups or the also other political groups which are well entrenched within the system, we cannot do much. And the independents are winning, that's true, but also they are a conglomerate of very, very different ideologically, politically driven groups, which means that once you remove the most common denominator from any movement or any messaging, you're going to have a fracturing of the messaging. And that's going to be a problem. Unless we can agree to some basic things, but that are actually vital and important. And from there on out, you can agree that, like, okay, we need to decentralize. We need to remove the pegging. We need to remove price control. We need to liberalize the market more. We need to get the government out of the monopolies that it holds on electricity, petrol, etc. Once you get these intact, then basically whoever gets the government can have change, but they cannot control the citizens from head to toe. And that's the major problem now, is that the government has everything. And as long as it does, you cannot do anything.
George is touching upon, you know, decentralization. Not just, I mean, some political parties would, you know, they would argue that currently power is decentralized. But I think the type of decentralization that George is talking about, if properly implemented, would not be neutral. It would have, you know, lasting effects on the different parts of the country and the different demographics of the country. Some will emerge more comfortable than others. And that really ties back again, back to what we were saying at the very beginning, that, you know, certain people of a certain demographic are grouped together in certain parts of the country. So you have some really powerful municipalities and some really powerful local governmental institutions that, you know, run a certain area and protect a certain area. So I'll give a very clear example. The area that I live in has much, much, much fewer electricity shortages than Beirut as a whole. And that's really because the local municipality has that under control and they govern it. And then you can also see the case of Zahle, for example. But you know, I agree with you, George, just to make it clear that I do agree with you. I just think from a humanitarian perspective, it will definitely not yield the same results for everyone in the country. It's not at the moment, just FYI. We have like a huge disparity in lifestyle and differences in like access to resources and everything. But then, yeah, I haven't touched on this issue much, but the existence of a militia in the country that is putting fear in people's hearts everywhere you go really will not help the growth of a country. We can't get anywhere if this militia continues to exist. I can't go to the street and protest and then be, because, you know, the people shooting at me are not the army. It's not the Lebanese army who's you know, shooting at the protesters, right? Maybe if we truly have, you know, not a certain group of people has an advantage over others simply because they literally have weapons and could start a war and just take over the whole country, then maybe we'd get somewhere. So I'm with George on this, but on a more, you know, emotional note.
I also want to add something on Marianne's note regarding the militia. It's that every now and then we get like a statement from Iran saying that if the negotiations in Vienna regarding the nuclear deal doesn't go well, we're gonna like inflame Lebanon next to Israel. It's like,
I was just gonna say, yeah.
You're a hostage.
Yeah,
they're just holding the country hostage.
Yeah. And also, for that matter, I mean, relating to neighboring countries, Israel regularly, when it feels like it, when it feels a threat, or to be honest, when it feels like it, just bombs southern Lebanon on, like, honestly, a fairly regular occasion.
Yeah, but by the way, Lebanon sent like a letter to the UN Secretariat about this. And the reply of the UN Secretariat was that the deal that you signed that led to the 59 and 1701 decisions, which basically said that Israel will not do these things once Hezbollah is removed from these areas. And so, like, Israel has a casus belli in this case, and you literally can't say anything because they know and the UN knows, and so do we know, the Lebanese army doesn't control the border, neither does it control what happens here. So
it's to me, it seems like almost the most complex set of catch-22s within catch-22s I've ever heard. And for those listening, in the sense of, you know, you do one thing, it always leads to the same outcome because you cannot actually change the framework of it. You cannot decentralize as much because that would just inflame inequality, which would inflame militias, which would inflame other issues. You cannot centralize too much because that will inflame corruption, will inflame issues to the citizens as well, and also lead to issues. And of course, dealing with Iran and Israel has never been a very easy situation.
And Syria.
That is a good point, yes. And of course, Bashar al-Assad is getting stronger and stronger in his position. I have heard commentators say that as soon as, you know, any final deal is made regarding the Syrian civil war, he will immediately turn towards Lebanon, because that has always been in the interest. And there are still, if I'm not wrong, many Syrian refugees in Lebanon as well, which only stretches the issues further. I think we're going to have to wrap up this this soon, but you mentioned messaging, and I want to ask if there is one message you wanted to kind of get out there, one message you think will be useful, both for those listening or just generally that will be useful for people to understand the situation. What's the message you want to give about the situation in Lebanon? How can they help, or how can they keep hope? Maybe I'll start with George this time, just so that we can end with Miriam.
So, okay, what I would advise you to do, because basically we've been trying to send money to Lebanon, but even if you have fresh dollars in Lebanon, you can't buy medication. So if you know someone that's going, or you are going yourself, ask your friends if they need milk for children, if they need some kind of medication, and work it out with them on that side. But also, I believe that now one message in the country can actually unify people, which is bringing those criminals to justice, and to just bring justice to those that were killed in the blast. And once you start by there, once you are able to actually touch upon the subject, which prime ministers and heads of security agencies and ministers and prime ministers and parliamentary members are all included, as well as the president, if you can do that, then basically the house of cards will start to fall and we might see some change, and that would actually galvanize people. So let's hope so. And thank you for listening.
Thank you.
I was really struggling to think of a meaningful message to share, but then the first thing that came to mind was the same as George, which is, you know, if you or anyone you know is coming to Lebanon and you can bring with you any of these basic goods, please do. They're literally out of stock everywhere, you know. And that's not quite a message after this very, you know, political discussion that we've been having. But what I would want people to do is just to stay informed and just read up about it if you can. Just once a month, you can just really check how far the currency has devaluated, and you'll see how bad it's going to be, a real life indicator of how bad the situation is going and how bad the situation is in the country. Just know that we're not happy with the situation. Know that we are trying, but it's really so much more complex than we can ever imagine. And just because certain, you know, militias or political parties are in power does not mean we want them there or we put them there. We really want them gone, but it seems like it's out of our control for now. So we really are trying, and that, you know, also keep in mind that there's a lot of injustice in the country that the population as a whole is dealing with. So keep in mind, bring medicine, bring baby milk, and know that we're suffering.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. This has been a very emotional and a very deep discussion. And honestly, I can't thank you enough for joining me today. I was only vaguely aware of the complexities from last year, from talking to Mariam, talking to you, George. And it's just truly, we could talk for days about this and there would still be more complexities to deal with. I have a link in the description as well. Obviously, for those who aren't going to Lebanon, any charities or anything, we can sort of donate to as well to help, but as you mentioned, it's getting harder and harder to actually get the help where it needs to. I truly hope that we do talk about this again sooner than another year. And when we do, the situation has improved. But as always, the industry will try and also keep things up to date, try and keep the news running so people are informed. Once again, I just want to thank you again, George, for joining, and Mariam for joining as well. It's been a great conversation. And I do encourage any of our listeners to read up more about it and to follow the rest of our podcast for more information about this and for other topics as well.
Thank you and have a good day.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity, Philippe, and have a great day, everyone.
Yeah, of course. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening. Do follow us. Do follow these wonderful people as well. And have a great day.